The Education, Finance, and Economic Competitiveness Division will come to order. Today we are going to be presented with the K-12 Educational Finance Supplemental Bill and that's House File 2475 and House File 3722, which is the Higher Education Workforce Development Supplemental Budget Bill. We are going to start with the K-12. Representative Greiling, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the chance to be here and get out my stuff.
While we're waiting for that, Representative Garofalo, there's minutes in the packet of the meeting from March 17th.
Madam Chair, I moved the minutes from March 17th. I've reviewed them and they are 100% accurate.
That being said, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. The minutes are adopted as read and printed. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like me to move the bill?
Yes.
I will move then. House File 2475. And I'll let you complete it, Madam Chair. We're going to the Finance Committee. That's correct. Two goes to be passed, and we refer to the Finance Committee.
Excuse me.
Okay. And what about the other committee?
Representative Greiling, before we move the adoption of the bill, the division reports.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, let me start again. Forget about what I just said. I will move the adoption of the K-12 Education Finance Division Committee Report for House File 2475.
All in favor of accepting the division report, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted, and House File 2475, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I will move House File 2475 for consideration to be referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill that, considering the deficit climate and the lack of funding that the House Education Finance Division is fairly proud of, that we eked out a bill like this year. And it does provide one-time funding for schools, kind of like a 1% increase, $51 per student. It's not on the formula, so it's not quite a 1% formula increase because it's not linked to compensatory or scarcity. But it is across the board for pupil funding that goes out to students all around the state. In addition to that, for the majority of districts that have money in their operating capital fund, they are also authorized to transfer from that fund into their general fund another $51 per pupil that they can use in this dire time for funding their school budget. So it kind of gets it up to an inflationary increase for schools. Those are probably the two major provisions of the bill. These are funded by taking the money that is currently not used and not in the pipeline as far as any district having applied for it from the QCOMP money on a one-time basis, and then it reverts back to being available to school districts again next year. And then we also have some of the money from the reserves and the governor's recommended 4% cut to the department to fund the bill. Some of the other provisions, Madam Chair, are a beginning for Representative Dietrich and Representative Garofalo's good work on the Permanent School Trust Fund, where payments that as it as the payments increase, they can be directed to go out to school districts for their use for technology. We eliminate the deduction for the wind energy tax district. The intermediate school districts have a better chance at borrowing for as other districts do. The there's more time to deal with capital bond repayments. The reciprocity that the governor's office, Commissioner Segrin, and Representative Marquardt worked on with the neighboring states are here, even though they were looking specifically at western Minnesota, it actually affects the borders all around the district. And there's provisions for individual districts. There are various other provisions. I'll just mention four more. And then there's the bill if anyone has questions. One is the Principals Academy that we had in our House bill last year is funded. The Special Ed Task Force that we started last year to try to look at how much Minnesota spends on special ed by exceeding the federal standard. They are commissioned to continue on and finish up. The school report card is here that we think is a big part of our ongoing education finance reform, changing how we measure, not just a simple standardized test, but multiple measures. And then many of you talked to counselors on the day on the Hill a couple weeks ago that Representative Tilbury has worked on some clearer language for the safe school levy to make it clear to local school districts that this must be used for school support staff. Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions. But the last thing I want to say is, before I do that, is we're very pleased that this bill doesn't resort to shifts and gimmicks. It's not borrowing or paying the schools late or anything like that. And we think that's perhaps a more major accomplishment than the amount of money that's available here. And that sets us up for the education finance reform that we're working on in the Education Finance Committee with Representative Slawick's committee with early childhood. We want to work together with early childhood and K-12 in the interim and set ourselves up for coming in with a major overhaul of the education finance system and then hopefully the will to fund it.
Thank you very much, Representative Greiling. It looks to me or sounds to me like your committee did a lot of work in a very short time, and we really appreciate that. Did you have, Representative Greiling, did you have time in your committee to hear input from various interests on the various parts of the bill?
Madam Chair, members, we did have quite a bit of testimony, and just yesterday we had general testimony on the entire bill. A lot of words of appreciation for the times and what we were able to do. And everybody was very realistic that this does not solve the school funding problems, but it just kind of keeps the schools afloat, and people were grateful for that and have high hopes for next year with our education finance reform.
I'm glad to hear that, Representative Greiling, and the fact that you had testimony and that there was every opportunity for people to testify on the issues that are contained in this bill, House File 2475, so that there should be no reason for testimony today. Except from the committee members, of course. And we have some amendments that are before us also, I understand. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling, could you explain to us how the QCOMP program will proceed based on the language and the use of that money in your bill? Because I have school districts in the pipeline, and I'm getting calls from them because they are at various stages. And very concerned that this is a signal to them that QCOMP is going away.
Representative Greiling, please clarify that. Because
yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, both Madam Chair up there and Madam Chair over here are supporters as you are. So it is a concern. It would not have been a taking of money from the unused money had it not been necessary in this climate of a huge deficit. But as of March 20th, last Thursday, the opportunity for districts to apply and be funded is closed off until next year. It does not harm districts that applied up through last week or districts currently getting the money. I know that Madam Chair, Representative Seifert was quoted right after this proposal as making it sound like the plug was being pulled on districts currently using QCOM, but that is not the case. So I'm sure he knows by now.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me continue. So, Representative Greiling, the March 20th date was the date already in place for the department to have approved or disapproved of QCOM plans. Is that correct?
Representative Greiling.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, there was some confusion on what the date was because there was one date in the draft bill, and then there was a date that staff was using to talk to people. And so Monday, I got a call from Mr. Crow to make sure we got that coordinated, and we gave the best possible window for any districts that we knew were currently applying, and that was through last week.
So, Madam Chair, thank you.
Erickson.
So, Representative Greiling, this is an arbitrary date set by whom?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, in order to do this bill, there has to be a date so we can put a number on it for when we actually heard the bill. So we set the date, you know, so that what information that we had in our committee yesterday was accurate. And we had to make that be the cutoff because every time we spend more money on QCOM for districts that were applying, and we did take all that had applied to date, then we would have to take more money out of the reserves to pay for the bill. So there had to be a time certain in order to figure out how much is coming from QCOM and how much is coming from the reserve. So yes, that is the final date now, unless some future committee changes it.
And Madam Chair, one final question.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greiling, then, for the record, when can schools resume applying for QCOM plans to be approved or disapproved by the Commissioner? Which fiscal year or which year of the fiscal years?
Representative Erickson, I am going to ask Mr. Crow about that because I think we all should know when that is so we can help spread the word about that.
Madam Chair and Member Representative Erickson, the way the bill is drafted, it just says that any district that applies after March 20th is not eligible for aid for fiscal 2009. So districts could apply today, they just wouldn't qualify for aid in fiscal 2009. So the application process and the approval process can proceed throughout this fiscal year. It's just those districts that apply after March 20th won't qualify for funding until the 2009-2010 school year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
For Mr. Crow, and maybe this is not an appropriate question for you, maybe the Commissioner needs to answer this. If the department has said to a school district who's working on their plan that they should be ready to levy in 2009, what does that mean? And, I mean, how does that then, how is that affected then by this possible proposal?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the any district that's applied and been approved by the commissioner by March 20th, or has applied by March 20th and then is subsequently approved, is allowed to collect aid in fiscal 2009 and levy for fiscal 2009. And the mechanics of that are funny because we're already levying for fiscal 2009, but that's the case under current law. And districts are basically allowed to double levy in subsequent fiscal years. And that happens with or without this bill when they're approved. They have to do a double levy in their second year of operation to make up for the levy that they didn't certify for the first year of operation. And so a district that's been okayed can receive aid or has applied by March 20th and is approved by the commissioner can receive aid for the school year starting this fall, and they'll be allowed to levy next year for the school for revenue for the school year starting this fall. So it won't change for those districts that apply by the 20th and are approved by the commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling, do you have an amendment that you want us to hear?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do. I would move the H2475A43 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
While we're looking, could the commissioner come to the table? Because I see some confusion on her face, the Commissioner of Education.
Oh,
to clarify the coupon.
Have time for the Commissioner of Education.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner?
I'm sure you
appreciate
the
time. Well, she was confusing me. Even though I wasn't asking her to sign.
Welcome, Commissioner Segrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm not sure why I'm here, but I'm glad to answer questions.
Well, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Segrin, is the interpretation given by Mr. Crow and Representative Greiling then accurate in regard to QCOP and for those school districts who are working on plans as far as one of my districts told me that they have been told that they could go ahead and levy for 2009. Their plan has not yet been approved, but, you know, they're spending a lot of hours getting ready for submitting their plan, and they don't want this to be for naught, and so I want to be able to encourage them, if at all possible. So I guess we need one more clarification.
Commissioner Segrin.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the question. We at the department, just to clarify, we do not have any kind of date final where districts have to turn in an application. So when Representative Greiling says that March 20th is the date by which you have to get your applications in, that was the date that the legislature set. So that you could figure out how much money you could recapture of the unexpended amount of money that is remaining for this fiscal year. We do have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 districts that are in progress that are in the approval process for an application. I'm not sure if yours is one of them. But we also have, in addition to that, probably 25 others who have applications in some form of process that will now not be able to go forward. We're very concerned about this. We really feel strongly that the QCOP money should be untouched because it is available for districts. It does send a confusing message to districts about whether the money is available. It puts off the planning, and it takes a lot of hard work to do a plan, and people spend a lot of time and good faith effort at the table talking. So we are very concerned that this money is being used in this way. We would prefer that the money be restored and that, you know, if you need other sources of revenue, that you discuss that. But this is not what we need you doing. But I do want to make it clear that we do not have any kind of a final date. We have an ongoing process by which districts can submit their applications to us.
Representative Heigerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for the commissioner, if she would
Commissioner.
Thank you. I know a number of years ago I served when we initiated the QCOMP. I was on the conference committee, and I did get an amendment passed where a certain proportion of those funds had to be allocated to rural Minnesota. And right now, the last numbers I've seen, I don't have those numbers with, but I know those numbers are well over 80% of the funds are going to the 7-county metropolitan area. And I'm not basing on school districts. I'm basing on pupil count now. Am I fair in my assessment that over 80% of the funding is going to the 7-county metropolitan area for pupil?
Madam Chair and Representative Heigerton, when we passed the QCOMP legislation, there was a requirement that we make sure that there was a balanced appropriation to both rural, suburban, and urban school districts. And we had, I think it was a year, or I forget what the timeline was, to make sure that the applications and the money is distributed in a manner that would reflect that. We did fulfill the letter of the law, and I think more than the letter of the law, in addressing your concerns. When you look at the per pupil numbers versus the numbers of rural districts, you are going to see a skewed count just because of the fact that in suburban and urban districts, you have many more pupils than you do in a small school district. But as a percentage of school districts, urban, suburban, and rural, we have a wonderful mix of rural. In fact, right now, we have North Branch. We have Annandale, Sauga Lakes, and we also have Fairmont that are all in the queue right now to be approved for QCOMP applications. I can get you the list of the rural districts that participate and the number of urban and suburban. We don't have the two urban districts. St. Paul does not participate, and Minneapolis has school sites that participate. And then we have some large suburban districts that participate, but because of their numbers, you're going to see that kind of skewed analysis. But as far as the numbers of rural districts and suburban districts, we have I think a very balanced interest and monies going out to the different districts.
Representative Heidegger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. But the numbers that I have seen, 50% of your students are outside the 7-county metropolitan area. The numbers that I have seen show over 80% going to the 7-county metropolitan area, where half the kids are. So I think we still do have a real serious problem. The problems that we're having, Chair Murphy, is that a lot of your rural school districts do not have business managers to go through this whole process. Your larger school districts tend to have staff to do that necessary work to get into QCOMP. And at the same time, we do have some gray areas that I know the Commissioner is very, very familiar with in regards to, I know Ed Minnesota has had some discussions with, I got one of my school districts is in litigation with the Department of Education in regards to this issue. So it's something that, you know, I was there when we first started. We went over to Waseca, we looked at the first program, and I had problems with it the way we implemented it. We should have implemented it with the first and second and third grade first rather than what we're doing right now, and I think that's some of the problems that the smaller school districts are having.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Seeger.
And Chair, Representative Heigerton, our staff has been very supportive of helping small rural school districts with their application process. We have had several opportunities for districts to come in to talk with other school districts that have implemented QCOMP to help them and assist them in you know, the different areas of planning for the application process. We actually travel out at the request of school districts to sit down with both their teachers and their management and help them through the application process. So we do everything that we can to be supportive of any district, whatever size that it is. And any district that wants the help can call us, and we'll travel out no matter what the distance is, and we'll spend time with the school district to help them if they are interested in participating. So our staff has really tried to be as helpful as possible, recognizing
that some of the schools don't have the resources as much as others. And we continue to try to provide conferences and seminars, and we will continue to do that going forward to help with any questions and any implementation processes that they may have.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Heidrichen covered my question. Thank you. I'll pass.
Any other discussion on Sioux Comp at this time? Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Greiling, Amendment Number 843.
That is right. I moved that one earlier, so I will renew my motion.
Thank you for reminding me.
Yep.
Would you like to explain what you're doing in this amendment?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. And before I do, I have one oral amendment on line 1.6. After strike, Ms. Larson tells us we need to add in the two words, the second, because there are two Mays on that line, and we only want to strike the second May.
Representative Greiling incorporates the second after the word strike.
And then, Madam Chair, what this amendment is, we had this general change of the ballot language for levy referendums approved yesterday in our bill, but since then there was some agreement that was reached with some of the affected education groups that the language that was in the governor's bill, which was also in Representative Erickson's amendment from yesterday, is actually what they decided to agree upon and thought that would give this a path that might be more positive. So this amendment incorporates all the language from Representative Erickson's bill, and I do have how it now reads, if you'd like to hear that.
Please.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, it now says, by voting yes on this ballot question, the notice required under section 3.3, whatever, may be modified to read, in cases of renewing existing levies at the same amount per pupil as in the previous year. And then the ballot question will read, by voting yes on this ballot question, you are renewing an existing property tax referendum. You are not changing your operating referendum amount per pupil from its level in the previous year. And then conforming with that on page 2, it says passage of this referendum renews an existing operating referendum at the same amount per pupil as in the previous year. So, Madam Chair and members, the intent is to make the ballot language neutral so that it doesn't make people get fearful that they're getting a tax increase, but also doesn't tell them that they, if they didn't vote for this, would get a tax decrease.
Is there any discussion? If not, all in favor of adoption of the 843 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. That's your amendment.
Madam Chair, that's the only amendment I had.
Representative Mariani, 840.
Madam Chair, I would move the 840 amendment. Madam Chair, I can explain this amendment.
Please do that.
Madam Chair, this amendment amends the part of the bill that deals with the report card, the school report card, which was part of a of a comprehensive bill that Representative Reiner introduced after working on it, actually quite closely with the Senate. Policy committees established a working group specifically on the report card provisions, and they worked for several months holding public hearings and engaging a broad group of stakeholders to suggest three new indicators to be added to the school report card at a later time. One of the indicators has to do with summary data that students would stem from students self-reporting on their sense of school safety, engagement in school, including the quality of those students' relationships with teachers, with administrators, and with other students. And the intent behind this survey, if you will, is really meant to produce an aggregate body of information that would fold all those elements together. However, there has been concern expressed by members and also by professional educators, teachers, that concern that as students are reporting, because it's obviously subjective information about their relationships with teachers, that somehow that would not be aggregate or just would not be aggregated, that somehow would make its way out into the public in a disaggregated form. And the intent of the school report card is not to do an evaluation of teachers. It's to do a measurement of schools. And so listening very closely to our friends in the teaching corps, we decided that because it was always our intent to have the aggregate data, to be very explicit that the information, the data collected here, is meant to be private, subject to our data privacy rules. So that's what this does. I think it provides strong comfort language to our teacher professionals and stays within the intent, clearly within the intent of the working groups that worked on this for several months and the chief author of the bill.
Representative Riley?
Madam Chair, it's a very good amendment.
Any other discussion? All in favor of A40, as explained by Chair Mariani, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Heidkirchen? No? Amendment?
Oh, I didn't have one.
A39?
I forgot I had an amendment. I forgot, I've not used it in the amendment.
Yes, it has to do with, thank you, Madam Chair, the A39 amendment. What it would do is delete what we passed yesterday.
Not even
my favorite amendment.
Just more, yes. But what it does is it keeps the Labor Day start for schools the same as it is now. And I'm not exactly sure what the amendment yesterday. I know that there were some exceptions made to the Labor Day start, and Representative Morrow, I thought I saw him in the room here. He was here earlier, but he had the amendment yesterday.
Yesterday's amendment changed the starting of school to August 31st for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because Labor Day is so late.
Right.
Is it September 6th?
It could be.
Something like that.
My argument on it with Representative Morrow is that right now we have school districts that are at 336 minutes, putting a little bit over 5-hour days in, And if we want to really address the problem of time spent in school, we can do like Benson did by adding 16 minutes a day and adding 6 days that way. And I think that's something we really need to look at in the future before we start messing around with calendars.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina,
sure. I'd like to support the Heidrich Amendment, and Representative Gratting, you know, I really think maybe people don't understand the impact this could have on, you know, the resort industry and even on things like the fair and that. And really, if this doesn't come out of this bill, Madam Chair, I'd like to re-refer it to my higher education and workforce development. Seriously, because I think it has, it should have some investigation as to the economic impact that it's going to have on everything, like I said, from the state fair weekend to the small resorts, the Montpaw resorts that are out there all across Minnesota. So I support the Heidrich Amendment. Representative Greiley, you should too.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question because I can't tell from the language. Is this a local decision option for local? Is it mandated that they start, or is it a local decision?
Representative Riley.
Madam Chair, a local decision.
Any other discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm going to vote for this amendment because I know that if I vote for this, then my friend Representative Rukavina is going to vote for my amendment later on. No, but in all seriousness, when I came to the legislature, I actually agreed with Representative Greiling, and I remember I had a meeting in my office a couple years ago where I had some resort people explain to me the significance of the Labor Day start, and they were literally in tears describing to me how when schools start before Labor Day, it is just devastating on the resort industry. You know, us down here in the suburbs, we don't really think about it that much. We go, well, geez, what's the big difference between August 31st and September 6th? What, it is absolutely devastating to the tourism industry up there. And local school districts don't, you know, they don't have those that metric in their calculation for school start dates. And I would encourage people to support the Heidrich Amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Garofalo, well, I probably won't support your amendments. I like you a lot more now. Just so you know that.
Any further discussion on A39? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as Representative Peterson pointed out, this is local control. The amendment that was added yesterday does allow for those early starts, but it's permissive. And I'm sure we have school districts who feel that based on perhaps their adequate yearly progress or, you know, some other more important issues called education probably should prevail, and they may want to get those extra days in before the Labor Day break. So, with that, Representative Rukavina, I have to stay with the education element of this because it's permissive and opposed the High Circuit Amendment.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, why can't they just add days at the end for 2 years? Because I have relatives who work up at the resorts, and Representative Garofalo is correct in what he heard in his office one day. So I support the amendment.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gratting, I just wanted to point out one more point. From those of us in the rural area, I've had the FFA students in and the 4-H students, and it's so important to them. And it becomes a family if you're really going to the state fair and isn't just the students. And so that really is a huge issue for them. And so they really are hoping that this is not go through. So I will be supporting the Heidrich Amendment.
Any other discussion? If not, Representative Heidrichen renews his motion to adopt A39. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted.
Yeah, he'll be back in house floor.
Representative Garofalo, A35.
Oh, there we go. This is a hot one.
How long is this one going to be?
Ooh, about an hour.
I could have a page, A35. Come over and take a page.
Oh, we don't have them. Oh, we do?
No, the runs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A35 amendment and request a roll call on it. Madam Chair, and Representative Greiling, first of all, I want to thank you. You glossed over it in your summary of the bill last night, but we passed a very important amendment on your committee last night regarding No Child Left Behind and preserving true local control for our schools as opposed to federal control. And I said it to you privately, but I want to say it publicly as well, that I want to thank you for allowing a free and open discussion on that amendment and for your vote in favor of my amendment. It means a lot to me on a personal level, and I think it sends a very strong message, not only to the constituents that we all represent here in Minnesota, but also to our federally elected officials, that we, as bright and as smart as they are, there's really nothing the folks in Washington can do that we can't do better here in Minnesota. So I did want to say thank you for that, and I appreciate it. All right, so now that we got the good stuff out of the way, let me apologize to the members of the K-12 committee, Representative Mariani, Heidi Gerken, Erickson, Representative Greiling, because what you're going to hear me say is very similar, if not identical, to what I said last night. First and foremost, this amendment was with regards to the compensatory funding formula, and for those that don't serve on the K-12 Education Committee, let me just offer a brief summary of what this is. Within our K-12 education funding, we have certain categorical aids that exist for different purposes. One of those is compensatory funding, which is to provide additional funding for children from low, to provide additional funding to schools for students who are from low-income families. And the thinking and the thought process on that is that those from disadvantaged or low economic households cost more to educate, and therefore the state should compensate school districts accordingly. Now, there's a couple flaws with our school funding formula, which I do, with regards to the compensatory funding formula, that I do not address in this amendment. Number one, under current law, we provide a 100% funding level for those in the free lunch program, and we provide 50% for those in the reduced lunch program. Now, there's no scientific basis for this. There's no rational expectation of why funding would be double for one versus the other. It's just the way it is in statute. I don't address that. Second of all, is the problem with compensatory funding right now is the concentration factor is determined on a per school level. So school districts are actually provided an incentive by the state of Minnesota to take all the poor kids and cram them into one school. Again, I do not address that, but what I do address is the issue of something called the concentration factor. And I could put everybody in this committee to sleep talking about how complicated it is, but basically this is the simplest way I can describe it, is that we don't treat every child in poverty the same in the state. We put in a compression algorithm so that as the concentration factor increases, as you move from 5 to 10 to 15% of the kids in poverty, it grows at a geometric curve. Again, not an arithmetic curve, it grows at a geometric curve. So for example, if a child in poverty is attending the Lakeville School District, the school district will receive an extra $294 per pupil. If that same child, same family life, same situations moves to the Randolph School District, they now become $316 worth of extra funding. From there, they move to the Farmington School District. Again, same situation, they get $482. However, if that same child moves to the Minneapolis School District, they now suddenly become worth $2,426 of additional funding. There is nothing rational, there is nothing informationally based about this funding formula. In honest candor, I had an opportunity to speak with the author of this provision in law. I reached my hand to him and I said, I want to shake your hand because you must be an engineer, obviously, designed this formula. Because only an engineer could come up with a formula that accomplished this. And he was very honest. He looked at me and said, oh, no, I didn't design the formula. I went to the staff and told them what I wanted. And then they designed the formula to do it. So what happens is under our current law, under the current concentration factor, we have school districts that on a per child in poverty basis receive anywhere from 400% to 700% more than other school districts. This is busted, it is broken, it needs to be fixed, and my amendment is a small, modest step towards correcting it. I would ask for member support.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Broccolo is right. That's the very same speech he gave yesterday. We resoundingly defeated his amendment, and I hope we do again today. It's really a redistribution of funding, and the problem comes in when you're when we're trying to address the opportunity gap, and then you take money from the districts at the low end of the opportunity gap to redistribute to others. And, you know, Representative Groffalo's amendment and many others that we had in education yesterday are really trying to deal with the fact that all school districts at present don't have enough funding. And since some people aren't willing to come up with any funding, they're trying them to take from other districts. And that's what this one does. It's really quite a cruel amendment. We discovered in looking at the runs that not only does it take from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, but also districts like Representative Hillstrom's inner ring suburban poor district, Representative Mary Ellen Otremba's poverty district in the rural area. Representative Marquardt made a very eloquent speech yesterday talking about how actually the largest per pupil funded district in the state is in his district. You know, these needs-based formulas help people, students, wherever they might be. And it's not just Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's rural districts. It's all over the state. And so I hope you'll defeat this amendment as well.
Representative Greiling, is there any place else in the 2475 that changes the formula?
Madam Chair, the compensatory formula. We don't change any formulas this year, but we do look forward next year to this education finance reform, where we are going to address the severe lack of funding for all districts. We also are addressing the compensatory formula, because Representative Groffalo, you know, always there's something right about what we all say, even when we don't agree with every part. And he's right that we need to fund it better for all districts, and then have the concentration factor for the seriously in need students. But we do need to do better with compensatory students in all districts. And that's what why we're working with the PS Minnesota group, and we hope to hear this bill in a couple weeks this year in preparation for next year in the K-12 Education Finance Division. Thank you.
Any other discussion, Representative Heidgerken?
Thank you. Just being at Representative Tremba's, my neighbor district there, Long Prairie was brought up. They may lose money, but when you look in reality, Long Prairie, the Long Prairie county that they're in, is the last time I saw it, was either the first or second lowest income county in the state of Minnesota. And you would think that they would be on top of the list as far as receiving these compensatory funds, but they're not. But then again, in argument, I agree with Representative Groffalo on the fact that a poor kid is a poor kid no matter where they're at. And I think that the system that we have is very, very flawed, and I think we need to look at it.
Any other discussion? If not, Clerk will call Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a comment that I hope we do take a very close look at compensatory revenue and the reasons that we have compensatory, because I'm not sure we have the accountability that we expect out of compensatory in regard to how the dollars are used. We've had compensatory for many, many years, and I think for the last 20 years or so we've had that concentration factor, and I think it is time for us to take a very close look at how these dollars are used, because I think if these dollars were being used to their fullest extent, we would have closed the achievement gap a little bit better than we have.
Clerk will call the roll.
Greiling?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Slawick?
No.
Rukavina?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Abler? Brown?
Yes.
Buns? Eastland?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Pass.
Heidgerken?
Yes.
Hornstein? Kranz?
Yes.
Mason?
No.
Kowalski?
Yes.
Ruth?
Yes.
Rude? Tilbury?
No.
Ward?
Yes.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Abler? Bunn? Hamilton?
No.
Hornstein? Kranz?
No.
Rude?
Vote is 10-10. The motion is not adopted. Representative Garofalo, 836.
Yeah, thanks.
Madam Chair?
Representative Heigerken?
Yes, just in regards to a procedure, if an amendment passed that has fiscal costs, does this get sent back to K-12 finance? Because it's going to be out of balance.
It goes to full finance.
It doesn't go back to K-12 finance?
I don't think so.
Even if it's out of balance?
I think it goes to full finance.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Am I up?
You're up.
Madam Chair, I would move the 836 amendment and request a roll call on it. You're getting the run distributed on this right now. I appreciate representatives, the members from the K-12 committee who heard this speech last night. This is a categorical aid, not the base funding formula. This is integration aid. And I will leave aside my comments about whether we should have a categorical aid that says we should be focusing on what kids look like as opposed to what they learn. That's a different conversation for a different time. But I think what an important discussion to have is how the integration aid formula is categorized in our state right now. First of all, for a majority of school districts, they do not qualify for this program. They're either not adjacent to or part of a district that has high minority populations. But for those other school districts, the overwhelming majority of them are placed into two separate categories. Category one is they receive aid of $92 per pupil. The second category is they receive $129 per pupil, and that's the way it is for the overwhelming majority of school districts in our state. However, three school districts are actually cited in statute as receiving preferred or special treatment. The first is Duluth, which comes in at $206 per pupil, and second is the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, which get a whopping $445 per pupil. Now, again, members, I'll make the case to you that should we pass this amendment today, let me suggest to you that this matter will be pre-conferred and will not come out of the conference committee with this provision in there. However, I would suggest to you that when you look at those numbers, again, $92,129 versus $445, this is not about public policy. This is not about getting the best bang for the results. There is simply no scientific, rational explanation from education performance perspective to justify one school district on a per pupil basis receiving almost 500% more than other school districts get. So again, using the principles that are in this bill that a child is a child, I wipe out the categorizations and I treat every program that is eligible for the integration aid program, I give them the same per pupil amount, which is $175 per pupil. I would ask for member support.
Representative Grinning.
Madam Chair, I think that the arguments I gave on the last amendment apply to this one, too, and I hope that members will likewise vote no on this amendment.
Representative Peterson.
I have one question. Did this integration aid come about as a result of the court's integration decision way back, a while back, quite a few years? But is this part of that agreement? A way of settling that court case?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I'm certainly going to be glad to be filled in by Representative Mariani or the staff, but I think that it is, and I think we would be in trouble without
it. Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Growling. It's just in my recollection that this was a way of settling a Supreme Court case, and court case could be filed again if we deal with this in a way that isn't agreed to ahead of time.
Representative Heikerton.
Madam Chair, we had the integration work group that met over this. I've carried the bill for the last 4 years having to do with this, and it has to do with, I think, with the 1972 desegregation court ruling. Since then, the auditor's report has come in and stated that it's outdated what we're doing. They have come out with the independent auditor's reports that we need some reforms. For example, within Duluth, they're collecting funds, and I think they're at probably 15% protected students. We've got some school districts with over 20% not getting any monies, and they're by statute getting monies because they were a city of the first class at the time. But there's right now what the bill is doing and the way it's working. Within, say, for example, Mary Ellen or Tremblay's district, where they have 40% protected students from K-1 through 6, if they would establish just a school site and have a higher concentration of protected students, they would get a lot more money. And that's exactly the opposite of what this court ruling wanted them to do. So we have some real serious flaws in the way we're appropriating this money. And it's something that we've discussed previously in K-12 finance the last number of years, but it's an issue that we need to look at.
I agree with you, Representative Heigerken, in the sense that it's something that we have to look at, and that we should look at it within the total budget of K-12 and not in a supplementary budget, and certainly not by amendment. Representative Grimey?
Madam Chair, and Representative Heigerken and members, Representative Heigerken and I served on the same subcommittee. It was a K-12 Finance Division subcommittee chaired by Representative Bill Mingus. Representative Mariani and others were on it as well. And we found that the reason we can't deal with the auditor's recommendations in terms of funding is because it costs another $30 million to do it properly, and we don't have that kind of money this year. The problem, like the last amendment, is not that the districts getting the money don't need it and aren't using it. It is that we need, because of changing time, more districts to qualify, like the districts that Representative Heigerken is referring to. So we have every intention of addressing this next year, and hopefully there's the $30 million to address it. There were policy provisions that the auditor recommended that I am disappointed that we're not doing this year, but we just decided to wait until we could do the full package, and we do need to do a lot of updating to this. Times have changed all around the state since this was first adopted.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, that was going to be my comment as well. You know, we are talking about Minnesota rules that are in play here that in fact do flow from some pretty turbulent times with respect to some pretty major legal action hanging over the state. I actually don't have the full history of this, but I think if we're going to delve into this, we ought to have all that before us and not do this on the fly here. We certainly don't want to violate any carefully agreed upon agreements that were meant to comply with, or at least to avoid legal sanction on the state. I don't know all the aspects of that, but I don't think we're going to be able to uncover that in the next few minutes in dealing with an amendment. I do think Representative Grayling is correct, and we're hearing that from a number of members on both sides of the aisle, that as our times change, our rules are going to have to change to reflect that. And there was initial efforts to look at that in the form of the work group this year. There were a number of issues that the auditor put forward, not strictly issues of funding. There were a number of issues in terms of what the use of the funding, what would be the appropriate use of the funding. There's some question about perhaps vagueness or perhaps too broad of a directive from the legislature. There's just a number of very sticky issues that we're not going to get at by simply attacking it from one aspect of this, which is just the funding aspect. And you know, frankly, I know my school district is in the audience here, and some others who are current beneficiaries. I think all these school districts need to know and be aware that things are probably going to be done differently in the next few years here in order to reflect the changing realities of Minnesota. But again, you know, doing this in a short, quick amendment in a short period of time is not a well-advised way to do this.
Representative Heidrichen.
Thank you, and I agree with Representative Mariani, but, you know, we've been waiting. This did pass 4 years ago on the House floor. Representative Seifert offered an amendment that passed into the bill. So it had been, it had passed in the House floor once before. But, again, the point that Representative Garofalo is making, he's making it very well, is that we have a lot of, and I pointed out with QCOM, where the money's going. We've got a lot of money going into certain areas and other areas of the state being left behind. And when we want to do referendums, we're left behind again because we can't access the same capital. So we have to look at, we've got some serious problems out there. A lot of school districts in greater Minnesota that don't have the means to fund education, nor do they have the dollars. They don't have these extra pools like compensatory, like QCOMP, like integration, and go on and on and on. We don't have those. Holding Ford's got $7,200 per pupil. And Minneapolis got $13,500. I'm sure we got a problem.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, this wrap. No one else got to talk, right?
Yeah.
Oh, but Eric, I just want to wrap things up so we put her on.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we do have accountability issues in how integration aid is used, and we know that from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. But could we have the Commissioner give us just a brief historical backdrop of the reason that we have this integration aid? Because we all seem to be wandering around here wondering how we got here and why we have what we have.
Commissioner, a brief background that I trust that anybody that sat in K-12 and had this amendment yesterday already knows the background, and I certainly remember how it went in. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, and probably the staff could even give a better presentation than I can. I know certainly I think you've already talked about the amount of money, the $445 that went to Minneapolis. And Duluth, I know both of them had lawsuits. St. Paul did not, but I think to recognize that St. Paul also had the same kinds of concentrations of poverty, the original integration monies were there. And then over time, the State Board of Education that no longer exists also started to promulgate a rule in regard to an integration policy. The rule that was going to be promulgated was going to say that de facto, regardless of where your students lived, you were going to have automatic busing back and forth. That didn't fly, so instead a rule was established that would say that once you hit a certain percentage within your school district, or you had a certain percentage that was more than an adjoining district, then you had to start to do certain things to address integration. And so then monies were awarded, a lower amount of monies were awarded to those districts then that started to have a percentage that was more than the rest of their existing sites are more than an existing adjoining district. And then there was supposed to be voluntary integration opportunities available for students so that students could be availed of opportunities so that there was not a segregated kind of an environment for children. So it started out, I think it was $92, $93, and the staff could probably fill us in as far as some of the other details, but that's kind of my rough, you know, 30 or 1 minute review of how it all came about. But it came about because of a state board rule and the money appropriated to actually implement the integration rule.
Thank you, Commissioner. Clerk will call the roll.
Greiling?
No.
Mariani?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Flawick?
No.
Rukavina? Murphy?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Abler? Brown?
Yes.
Yes. I'm sorry, no.
Bunn? Eastland?
Yes.
Erickson?
Yes.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Heidgerken?
Yes.
Hornstein? Kranz?
No.
Nathan?
No.
Kowalski?
Yes.
Ruth?
Yes.
Rude? Tilbury?
No.
Ward?
No.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Rukavina? Abler? Bunn? Hornstein? Rude?
Nine to ten, the amendment failed.
Could we demand a refund?
No.
Well, at least Rod was listening to this.
Representative Ward, 842.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move 842 to be included, and this is the FIAD bill. And there has had a number of discussions and dialogue, and I'm not going to expound on it as well. I just want you to know that since yesterday, since it was failed in K-12 yesterday, we have gotten together with parties interested and negotiated since then. This amendment takes out a lot of the concerns that were addressed yesterday. It represents language that was passed off the House floor last year in 07. It takes away the fiscal note. There's no rulemaking because standards are currently developed to guide the school districts through quality teaching network or the national standards, whichever the local school district chooses to use. We're putting in the academic standards K-12 and asking in high school over a 4-year time that a half a credit of FIAD be required. Lots of dialogue has been around health care reform in this arena recently and addressing the childhood obesity epidemic. And so, as my good friend Representative Graving says often, let's cut to the chase and just make this get FIAD as a required academic standard in our schools like it was from 1936 until 2001. With that, Madam Chair, I will say no more. I would ask for your support. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I hope that I sincerely hope the committee will put this on. I would be proud to have it in the bill like we did last year. And I'm glad that Representative Ward has worked out the fiscal costs and the controversy so that hopefully this committee can see its way clear to put on. And he's right, all the health care committee is doing is trying to point out if kids are obese, but Representative Ward's bill actually does something about it. They get to be active, and I think that's what we would want the schools to do, not the health care part.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ward and I, we've worked on this in the past. And again, the problem that we're having, and if anybody sat on the school board, and I know the School Board Association would not be happy with this, that's another mandate. Right now, your local school districts already have FIAD requirements in place. Right now, we have certain school districts that are down to a 6-hour day. I've got a couple more in my districts that are going down to a 5-hour day to get where Minneapolis is at 3:36. That way they can cut another hour out and cut some more teachers out and yet meet the budget. What's happening out in a lot of your school districts with declining amount of money, this is a very, very high cost stakes you're playing with school districts. It's going to cost them a lot of money because this is another requirement. And when you add another requirement, you're taking band away. As an elective, you're taking choir away, you're taking industrial arts away, you're taking away a computer class, you're taking away a lot of other foreign language. Among other things, they're not required. And right now, you only got so many periods in a day. And pretty soon, they got no electors to choose from anymore. And until we address the time of requiring all school districts to spend a certain number of minutes in the classroom, we can't afford to do this. And so I'm speaking for all of the other electives, and in some school districts, there's quite a few that are competing for this time period. And I think it's best left up to local school districts to decide. We already have all the standards in place, and probably too many. And to add another one, I think it's something we need to seriously look at, and it's if you've been on the school board, if you've ever been a teacher, you know what I'm talking about.
Representative Ward.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hydrogen, I appreciate and respect that comment. I do know this, and I was a teacher, you know that. Most schools offer physical education at this point, and matter of fact, about eight through the department's own statistics, about 80% of the schools in the state of Minnesota have requested academic standards from the department to implement them or to look at implementing them. So, again, this is something that most school districts have, and I just think it's important to, an active child is a healthy child that can learn better academia. So that's the purpose of it, and I appreciate and respect your comment.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really... I'm hearing what Representative Heigerken is saying, but I also serve on the Health and Human Services Committee, and I have listened all session to the health care reform and what we're trying to do in terms of prevention, and it starts very young, and particularly with obesity. That's one of the diabetes and obesity are two of the most prevalent kinds of diseases, and they start very young. And part of it deals not only with the way that you eat, but also with exercise and how you learn to exercise, lifetime exercising. And I think we can't afford to separate out the Phi Ed and have it as an option. I think it has to be in so that our students are healthy, not only ready to learn, but in the long run, hopefully save money in the whole healthcare package that we're trying to put together.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll speak on behalf of my half-brother, Representative Ward, and support his amendment. Before I was a math teacher, I was a physical education major, and physical education classes are more than just running around playing badminton and soccer and whatever else they do in the gym or outside. They have nutrition classes, health classes, and I think it's important when you look at our society today of all the obesity and correct, obesity is tied to diabetes, these kids should learn what it takes to lead a healthy lifestyle, and I think it's a worthy cause.
All in favor of the 842 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. I don't see any other amendments. Representative Peterson, yes, 838.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment deals with a school district being able to run referendums at times other than the regularly prescribed time, but only under certain circumstances. Under current law, a school district must hold this referendum at the November election date unless the district, conducts an election by mail or the district is in statutory operating debt. Now, statutory operating debt means that you're 2.5% under the operating ability in finance. And it's a financial condition that says the district's debt negative unreserved general fund balance is less than 2.5% of the total expenditure of the same funds. Now, if you're in statutory operating debt, you can hold a referendum election at a different date subject to the approval of the Commissioner of Education. And this bill would allow a district with a fund balance of less than 3% of its expenditure to hold an election at a different date as well. In other words, we're allowing some exceptions for districts that are already in SOD, statutory operating debt. But when you get to districts who are very close to statutory operating debt, we're saying you have to really go under in order to have that same privilege. It seems to me that we might raise that bar so that we can save districts from going into statutory operating debt by allowing them, when they reach the 3%, to have the same operation of referendums as those who are already in statutory operating debt. Now, granted, I come from a district where our referendums did not pass. And we had some unusual circumstances with outside groups coming in where it did not pass. And we're very close to the statutory operating debt. But we are not the only district. There are many districts in the state that did not pass referendums and are very close to that same level of operating. And in other words, they could probably next year be in SOD and able to run those referendums. This seems like a good bill, not only for the district that I represent, but for all districts who were not able to pass those referendums during the last time around. And it seems to make sense. We're keeping people from drowning, as I said before. We're keeping them above water for a little while.
Representative Grotting.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, and members. This is a really good amendment that I'm unfortunately going to have to oppose just because of the tails cost. We like this in the K-12 committee. It's an unfortunate bill of many unfortunate bills that we looked at this year of what to do when the state isn't providing adequate funding for schools. You know, should we just let them levy? Should we let this? Should we let that? Unfortunately, we have to account for those costs, and there isn't the money to do this bill in our tails target. But otherwise, I really like the bill, but I unfortunately have to oppose it.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, could I ask our fiscal analyst what this bill would cost in terms of levies and tails? Do you have that information?
Mr. Krause.
Madam Chair and members, the estimate on the tail cost is around $700,000 in fiscal year 2010 and 11 in aid, and an additional levy impact of about $8 million, a little over $8 million additional levies passed.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. That is, it's interesting. When I put this bill forward, I thought that it was strictly a policy bill, and I certainly didn't anticipate tails that were quite this significant. And so I agree that I know what the committee has, the K-12 committee's had to deal with in terms of trying to fit within the targets that were given to them, both in the operating but also in the levies and obligations and tails into the future. I think the $51 that you have is more important than this bill, and I'm going to withdraw it because I know it will never get through the Finance Committee. And that's too much money, but I will be back again with it next year unless we get a new funding formula which allows us not to have to go after referendums in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Peterson. I thank you for bringing this amendment forth, because hopefully next year Representative Frank Moe had a bill eliminating referendums and going back to what the state had promised in the tax reform bill of paying for all of education. So hopefully we can eliminate referendums altogether next year and do it right and do the tax reform bill the way it's supposed to be done.
Thank you. Representative Peterson withdraws 838. That concludes the amendments that I know of and that were in by 10 o'clock.
as prescribed. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think we had a good bill coming in. I think with the amendments that have been put on today, it's an even better bill, and I thank you for that help and hope you'll support the bill.
Appreciate your work, Representative Greiling. I think you can go forth with pride. All in favor of the Greiling... Representative Demmer, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't realize we were ready to vote just so quick. I just wanted to make some general comments about the bill, Madam
Please
Chair.
Please do.
We went through this pretty thoroughly in K-12 last night. We had additional amendments, Madam Chair, and some of the same that you heard today and some in addition to the ones you heard today. Madam Chair and members, Representative Grousing, I know you spent a lot of time at work, and I know you did some things to accommodate me, and I appreciate that in this bill, especially the windmill money, and I think that's a good change. But Representative Greiling and members, I can't support the bill, as you might not be surprised about. There are a number of things that are just overriding, and, you know, I guess one of the things that I have to comment on is we talk about local control. Madam Chair and members, we talk about local control, but just let me just summarize our conversations about local control. It seems to me that we favor it when they agree with us. It is something that we don't think the locally elected officials, and I'd even go beyond school boards, but I'm going to talk about school boards today. If they agree with us, we think it's something they should have a choice about. If they don't happen to agree with us because of the perspective that we come from, then we think it's too important to leave it to local control because for some reason we think we have the authority and we are smarter. And there was comments made about even at the federal level, we're not going to let them say they're smarter than we are, so we can do it the way we want to do it, and we're not going to comply with those things. Well, Madam Chair and members, I think we need to look in the mirror when we talk that way, because I think there's many of us here that take the approach that school board members, for some reason, don't seem to have the kind of knowledge and understanding we have, and therefore we have to tell them what to do, unless they agree with us, and we can give them local control. So that's my thoughts about that. Integration aid and compensatory, they're addressing this bill, but there's reform that's needed, and that's not in this bill. And this is not a budget year, and I realize, I don't know if there's going to be a policy bill coming or not, but we're dealing with policy in here, too, and these are things that are not addressed, and everybody agrees that something should be done. And quite frankly, the idea that we would be the first state in the nation to pull out of No Child Left Behind, Madam Chair and members, that might be seems to be a noble and a fun and a sexy thing to do, but this is serious. Representative Greiling, you talked about tails, over $200 million. And you know who it affects? You know who it affects, Representative Greiling and members? Those $200 million are affecting the underprivileged children that I hear so much talk about in this committee. We're talking about all the titles. Title I, Title II, Teacher Prep, Title III, Limiting English Proficiency, Title IV, Safe and Drug-Free Schools, Homeless Education, Migrant Education. And that's not even talking about Head Start and IDEA, which we're not clear what the results will be. $200 million plus, members, that we're going to need to come up with. And I was, last night, one of my bills had a $32 million cost, or $41, whatever it was. And that was, it was a gas because it was going to be in the tails and it was going to be a problem. This is over $200 million. This is serious. And quite frankly, if I was the governor, this wouldn't see much time on my desk when we're looking at doing this sort of thing. So members, I would appreciate you can give some deep consideration. We'll have a chance to talk about this some more, probably in another venue, but I would appreciate a no vote on the bill.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you did bring up an issue, and I was not part of the committee that discussed this, No Child Left Behind. Are there tails? Is there an indebtedness? Is there money that we're losing? Is the legislation, I haven't even looked at this to see if there are tails associated with that. Could the chair answer that question, please?
Mm-hmm. Representative Greiling. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, there's about, I think, $219 million that if we got sanctions, there's different amounts according to who's calculating what the sanctions might be. We did discuss in the committee yesterday that we're not aware of states that are sanctioned. You know, the federal government issues a lot of mandates from on high, and if states don't do them, we're not aware of states that have actually been sanctioned. So it could be construed as a game of chicken with the federal government. But the other thing is that with this amendment, staff has told us that it's not an opt-out of No Child Left Behind. So if we want clarification of that, we should check with Ms. Larson. But I think what Representative Brocklow is doing and that the committee supported is a signal to the Washington people, the Department of Education, and all those who are marching down this path of all school districts not complying with No Child Left Behind by 2014, looking at our legislative auditor's report, this is kind of a shot across the bow that we need to really look at what we're doing and try to help schools, not punish them. And for that, our committee supported it. But as far as losing the funding, we were not taking that terribly seriously, Representative Peterson.
Representative Rasslow.
Madam Chair, just to echo Representative Chair Greiling's comment, that studies have shown that while we do receive this $217 million in fiscal year 08 from the federal government, the implementation of these mandates costs more than that. So even if in the doomsday scenario we lose the game of chicken and they do pull the funding, we still end up saving money for our local school district.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say, I'd just like to bring up a couple points when we're talking about education. You know, there's been some flyers that have been passed around that points out that there's certain schools that end up with $16 million more dollars than what they had expected. And I just want to bring up the point again, rural Minnesotans have very similar issues as well. I appreciate my good friend Representative Garofalo bringing up his amendments. However, the first amendment that I did vote against, Representative Garofalo, would have transferred dollars out of a couple of my school districts and reallocated those to a few others. So even though I had a few that won, I also had a couple, two, three, that would have lost. The other thing that I want to stress again, just to reiterate that we have issues out in rural Minnesota as well. Our Commissioner Segrin sent this out for my daughter, which I'm going to brag here a little bit too because I'm a proud parent. You take a look at the school in which she goes to school at, and they do meet the state standards. However, they are below the state average. I mean, we have similar issues out there as well. As a proud parent, I would like to point out the fact that parents play a very integral role in the education of children as well. And so if my daughter's watching, she did exceed the standards. And had very much exceed the standards. I'm proud of that. But
a smart mother.
Yeah. That's right, Representative Ruth Avina. Her mother is very bright. She's very bright. But again, as we move forward, I just want to point out the fact again, rural Minnesota does have similar challenges as other parts of the state, and we need to make sure that they're being provided and taken care of as well. So let's keep that in mind as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just responding a bit to Representative Garofalo, I'm not so sure that we're going to save that money. Most of No Child Left Behind has already been put into statute, and districts are pretty obligated unless we really examine how much money each district gets and then examine what's in statute. I don't think we can make a prediction that we're going to save money or even come out even. And I'm really concerned about this being in. Now, I'm not a fan of, you know, all of the things in No Child Left Behind, and I was hoping we would have a president who would say, you know, this needs to be changed and after November. But I would like at some point somebody to do some kind of analysis of what would happen to each school district if we lose $200 million, because I know we don't have that in the budget to replace, and that's a lot of money for many districts. So thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to echo some of what Representative Peterson said. To think that we're going to not have all these titles and to maybe possibly not even have money to fund Head Start, that's a question mark, I realize. But to think that we're not going to do these titles and we're just going to save $200 million and because we're not going to have some testing, we're going to save some money, are we not going to assess kids? Are we not going to evaluate our schools and hold them accountable for achievement? Are we not going to have programs for underprivileged kids like we have now? So are we going to do them all for free? I guess if we mandate the school districts and tell them they have to do more referendums, we could do it for free from the state perspective. I think we have to think about that. We're going to save some money maybe on some testing if we're not going to assess kids, and I'm still wondering how we're going to... I still haven't had a teacher tell me yet how they assess kids without having some sort of testing in conjunction with their experience with them. But I think we have to be a little realistic when we think about these members. Thank you.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember 4 years ago, roughly, in Ed Policy, we almost offered an amendment to
withdraw from No Child Left Behind, and then we had the votes in the committee, but because of the millions of dollars we were going to lose, we decided not to do it. But and I have always been kind of a proponent of getting rid of No Child Left Behind, but after sitting in a meeting with Secretary Spellings the other day, it looks to me like she is trying to address the needs and the shortfalls of No Child Left Behind and letting states do their own. I know that Commissioner Seagren's got a plan to submit, allowing, and if it's approved by the Secretary, that we could be waived out of No Child Left Behind, and she wants states to start figuring out on their own what they do best, and so that gives me some reason to start believing in No Child Left Behind again, or at least give it a chance to see if we can, if the Secretary can really allow states to address the issues on their own and do it, in our case, the Minnesota way. So, and I think Representative Dimmer made a good point. If we do opt out and lose the $219 million, we still have to test somehow. And it's my understanding that we're trying to eliminate some of the testing so that we can consolidate into one or two tests. So just keep that in mind when you start voting on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Griling moves that House File 2475 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All in favor of the Griling motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No.
The motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Representative Rukavina. House File 372.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm just, Madam Chair, going to briefly go over the bill and then open up for questions. You know, we were asked to, but the governor had proposed a $25 million cut approximately in both the university and institute system, actually a little more at the university. And we just felt in the committee that...
Excuse me, Representative Rukavina, before you start, will you move with the adoption of the division report?
I'm sure I'd move the adoption of the division report, the House File 3722.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Okay, well, anyhow, in getting on with what I was saying, Madam Chair and members, you know, tuition had risen 70% over the last 5 years at our higher education system, and because of the $380 million cuts we made back in the 2003 legislature, and I just said that I just couldn't do that again because we had finally put an end to double-digit increases at our higher education facilities, and so I looked for different sources of money. I do, however, have a number of the governor's initiatives in this bill for cutting. The governor proposed a $2 million cut from the Job Skills Partnership Board, which is in the bill, $608,000 from the Foreign Trade Zone account, which is in the cuts in the bill, $150,000 from a meth lab cleanup fund, ADD, that's in the bill, a $223,000 base cut to the Office of, or to the, in total for Labor and Industry, Mediation Service Bureau, and the Office of Higher Education. His $8 million proposal for transfer from the Workforce Development Fund to the General Fund is in here. And then I cut both systems approximately $6.2 million. And I didn't want to even do that, but both systems and the bill guarantees it won't be passed on to the students. Both systems have told me that they can live with that if I'm speaking with her.
I think they're here, but they're nodding their heads. We did fund the governor's recommendations for business loans to returning veterans, and we enabled veterans to use services from the Displaced Worker Program. We funded the governor's recommendations for $2 million for six rural economic initiative funds. The governor had a $400,000 appropriation for the Office of Science and Technology with Indeed. We funded that. Now, you know, we probably should just get right to the parts of the bill that some people on the committee probably will not like, but we transferred $14 million from the Workers' Compensation Special Fund to the General Fund. It's not precedent-setting. In fact, in 2003, the governor and then the House, Republican-controlled House, transferred $265 million from the same fund to balance the budget. Remember, I'm doing this not only to balance the budget, but not balance the budget on our students in our higher education systems, again, like we did back in 2003. It doesn't jeopardize that fund at all. In fact, the assessments and premium surcharges will probably still be lower than they, well below what they were in 2004. I took $7 million from the governor's Achieve program, which started last year, members. It's an untested program. I referred to it as a resume builder for our governor last night in committee, but it's at a time when we have a deficit like we have, I thought this was a place to get money because this program it hasn't been used other than slight appropriations this year. I think of about $3 million. But, there are some programs in here regarding IRRRB, which is in the jurisdiction of our committee. I'm probably going to have a little attack on that. But again, members, mining companies pay no property taxes. They pay in lieu of property tax based on their production. And since most of the mines are in my district, I'm the one that probably has a greater fiscal disparity district than Representative Linchevsky, who talks about how much she shares all the time. So there's some changes in there. And other controversial provisions in the bill, I have a $5,000 exclusion for severance pay when determining unemployment insurance. This was always a policy in this state until the mid-90s. Other states do have allow severance and other holiday payments, things like that, to be excluded from unemployment insurance benefits. I added four labor representatives to the Minscu board, as I tried to do last year. I think it's very important that people in the trenches also have some say on our Board of Trustees at Minscu. There's a program in here that publishers don't particularly like that provides equal access to instructional material for blind folks. The Power Review program is continued in this bill. Currently, it's at Minneapolis and St. Paul, and there's some trial programs in four other places in the state. Representative Carlson had this bill. There's also a teacher of color program that Representative Norton had. I don't think the private colleges particularly like these two programs I just mentioned. I mentioned we did some of the governor's seed initiatives, but we just didn't think it was the proper time to expand government within the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And one of the things I did in here was using the same formula that Deed paid for the computer system that we all heard about this early winter. We placed a real live human being in all 47 of the workforce development centers in the bill. The bill also funds the Boxing Commission, which has a big part of this bill that Representatives Gunther and Mahoney worked on with the governor's office. And there is a $2 million reduction in the Minnesota Investment Fund that was for Thompson West in last year's bill that never got used. And
I set aside $1 million of that for a new biomass energy conversion program, similar to what the Governor Perpich had years ago for using native fuel, since we're on our path to 25% of our energy being used in 2025. So that's a quick overview of the bill, and I stand for any questions. I think I touched on all the major spending items in the bill, Madam.
Representative Savina, you have an amendment?
I believe I have a technical amendment.
825?
Yes. When we made some accepted, there's a cross-reference where we got some sections mixed up when the bill was printed, and the effective date is a retroactive date. I accepted Representative Gunter's amendment yesterday on the Ainsworth unemployment extension, and he didn't intend to, I don't think, retroactively or to take out the retroactivity, which is the reason why it was in there. So I'll offer up the A25 amendment.
Is there any discussion? All in favor of the adoption of the A25 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion is adopted. Representative Erickson, A23.
Madam Chair, I move the A23 amendment into the roll call.
Representative Erickson moves to adopt the A23 amendment. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. The A23 amendment would delete the Power of You program and its funding. I was not familiar with the Power of You program, but realize that it has a lot of support from our business and philanthropic community, and I think that, you know, it functions very well within that realm of the private input, so it doesn't seem to me that it needs state funding at this time. The Teachers of Color Financial Aid Pilot Program, it looks to me like that's establishing a new program. I was an original author of the regular Teachers of Color Financial Aid, but this, it seems to me, extends and provides a new program at a time when money is tight. And I do, in deference to the governor and the work that we did on the Achieve program in the last couple of years, move that money into supporting the Achieve program, which I think offers incentive statewide for our students moving from high school to college. Hopefully they have taken rigorous courses to support that one time, I think it's $1,200 award that they received.
One of the first presentations in this committee last year was the Power of You. It was a program that seems to be received very well. Representative Rukvina?
Well, Madam Chair, I would oppose the amendment. First of all, you know, the ACEED program, Representative Erickson, it hasn't started yet. And, you know, if the governor wants programs, he's got to pay for them, but that isn't the case around here. But, you know, I sat in conference committee, and the ACEED program is not a very rigorous program at all. In fact, they compromise and compromise it down. Under current law, any student who meets the required state graduation standards carries a C average, I think, and takes a foreign language, qualifies for a scholarship with just about everybody. So if he wanted rigor, it wasn't there. This was just something the governor wanted. Like I said, I thought it was a resume builder myself, but, you know, that could be just my opinion. As far as the Power of You, I think Representative Mariani can probably
speak a little bit on how successful that's been, and I think the program runs out now, so, you know, Representative Carlson thought it was important enough that it should not only continue to be funded, but should be expanded with some pilot programs. And finally, I think the Teachers of Color pilot, and you're right, this is a pilot, but the Teachers of Color program has been around in the past. It was eliminated, and we did some funding. We got some good testimony on it. It's not that much money, and I would hope the committee would vote on the amendment and give these programs a chance to continue to prove themselves. And again, on the chief members, chief program, I have to find money somewhere that isn't going to raise tuition like we did 3 or 4 years ago, so 5 years ago now. So I would hope that the committee would oppose the amendment.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Reese Drukavina, a chief didn't start out to be the watered-down version that came out of conference committee. It started as a high-quality program. So it is supposed to be an award for students across the state who really are involved in rigor. And, you know, wasn't my doing that it got watered down. And so I think that, you know, to suggest that it's a resume builder is wrong. And it was very important in our goal to raise achievement at the high school level to give our students an incentive as they entered college, because they took rigorous courses. So I'm hoping we can return to that, even though there's not language here.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, this is probably the classic, you know, taking from Peter to pay for Paul. And all I can tell you is that, Representative Riccovina, you and your committee have carefully talked about these issues. You know, the Teacher of Color program has some a long history with this body. We lost it during severe budget cut years. It produced a very much needed element to our state in terms of diversifying our teacher corps, which is part of one of the strategies that's necessary to be able to address achievement gap issues. Had broad ownership with higher ed, with communities, direct benefit to K-12 schools. The Power of You is a more newer effort, but nonetheless, members, it's one that's really brought an incredible amount of hope and opportunity in communities where there really was no hope, no opportunity. It's really exciting to see these students who the furthest thing from their mind, you know, was to go on to school and to college, and partly because of the fear of cost, and now you've got, you know, just basic average, you know, kids, you know, who are saying, you know what, this is doable for me, and I'm going to make a really strong effort. It's great to see that excitement out in the community. Having said all that, you know, we're talking about three terrific programs, and I wish that Representative Riccovina, members, we were in a position where we weren't having to take from Peter to pay for Paul. I think there's certainly enough resources and wealth in our state to be able to fund really good programs across the board. And so that's really our big failure here. But we're not going to advance, you know, good causes by taking from one good program to fund others. And so I would respectfully oppose this amendment.
Representative Bruce. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I certainly agree with Representative Mariani. We have great programs here, and the Power of You program has worked great. The issue that I'm very concerned about is the metro-rural issue again, and the disparity that we have in our funding. The Power of You program has been successful in having a business partnership, and that's what we've been trying to do. And I thank Representative Riccovina for letting them talk to us, because it was very interesting, and it is a terrific program. But again, if the businesses are, it is successful because the businesses do believe that it is a good thing, and so that's what we want to encourage. Taking the money from a seed is a huge concern to me. Particularly, the seed program is a statewide program. It isn't just for rural Minnesota. It's a statewide program. And the Power of You is only for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
That concerns me. Already we have a huge funding gap in health care. In the rural area, our nursing homes don't get funded with the reimbursed at the metro rate. Okay. Transportation, we just had some of ours taken out again in the rural area for the metro transit. Education, we saw the gap widen this year in funding. Now, you know, we all want to be fair, but remember, we are state representatives, and ACHIEVE is a statewide program. ParaView is not. I really have a problem with the metro-rural issue, and we have diversity in the rural areas too, members. And so we really need some help, and this would just, again, take more away from our rural area. So I hope that we can support the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, for the committee's information, Representative Ruth, I thought maybe you weren't at the committee hearing when it was proposed by Representative Carlson, but in the bill we expand the program to two more pilots in the rural area and two in the suburbs. So it actually becomes a suburban, inner city, rural program. So just so the committee knows that, I appreciate your vote against the amendment. Remember, one important thing I should, I think I'll talk about it after.
Representative
Peters. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have to support and make a few comments about the teachers of color. I think all districts around the state have diversity in their schools, some more than others, and the district that I'm in has about 50% now of diversity and people of color. And we do need to have teachers who represent those communities of color, and this is an opportunity, I think, to develop a program to recruit, retain, maybe even retrain people who want to be in teachers, and it works with the higher ed institutions, and it will prepare some of our people of color to be teachers in our schools, and I think that's very important, and this looks like a good pilot program, and I would support it.
Representative Roo.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Well, I just have to comment to that, because certainly we want teachers of color, but that to me shouldn't be an issue. We shouldn't have to have a program for teachers of color. It should be whoever is the best qualified person for the position. So I just wanted to make that comment, Madam Chair. Any other discussion? If not, Representative Erickson renews her motion to adopt A23. All in favor, say aye.
I call the roll call, please.
Roll call has been asked for.
Rukavina?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Riling?
No. No.
Mariani?
No.
Flawless?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Habler? Brown?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Eastland? Erickson?
Yes.
Garofalo?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Heidgerken?
Yes.
Hornstein? Kranz? Mason?
No.
Kowalski?
No.
Ruth?
No.
Yes. Hi.
Rude?
No.
Tilbury?
No.
Ward?
No.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Seven to 13, the motion is not adopted. Representative Ruth, A26.
I see, Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Garofalo has asked if he might have his script because he has to leave for another
commitment.
This is Chairman Carlson. So it's 824.
So I will concede. All right.
Madam Chair, I move the 824 amendment.
Yeah.
And all this does is take the appropriation that was passed last year and makes it available until 2009 in case there's any carryover funds. My understanding is that Representative Rubino is in support of this amendment.
And the appropriation for what, Representative Garofalo?
On page 94, there's an appropriation that says to allow that on behalf of licensed vendors to coordinate their efforts to respond to solicitations or other requests from private and government units to extend employment opportunities for those with disabilities.
Representative Rukavina.
Chair, Representative Garofalo is correct, and I told you earlier that I'm starting to like them more and more. This is a good program that was for persons with disabled folks, and I don't mind that we keep the appropriate, whole until it runs out. Otherwise, we'd just have to do that. I don't think it causes any trouble with it.
Okay, with the Minnesota Works Program, H24. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Ruth, age 26.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We talked about this before. This writes a new language that pays the $5,000 before and does not affect severance pay, bonus pay, etc. The cost is exorbitant, especially when we make it retroactive to 2006. It involves about 20,000 people, and it's a $20 million cost for the retroactive cost. We're looking at, looking out to 2008, it would be about $11.5 million, and each year thereafter, it would increase about $1 million per year. This would become a direct tax increase on our employers. Already, I think we've gone all the way from 49 up to the 42nd worst in the nation for business, and this again would make it just worse for our businesses. I would like to hear more about the history of the severance and costs involved, and I see that Mr. Nelson is here from Duke. Could we possibly have him come and explain that to us, Madam Chair?
Gee, I don't know that I need any more explanation. I remember negotiating this in conference committee last year very carefully, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
In fact, this might be my language even.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but I think as we're going
this
forward,
is like
I would like
tearing to out my heart. We worked very hard to get this language in an acceptable form at conference committee so that everybody would be happy. Haven't you been happy for a whole year?
Madam Chair, this really hurts me to see businesses be suffering in this way with the tax increases. So I would be very happy if Mr. Nelson, I would be happier. I'm certainly happy, but I'd be happier if Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Nelson, Commissioner? No, and I haven't had anybody else except the commissioner here today.
Madam Chair, how about if we allow 6 minutes? Five. I'll negotiate to five.
Mr. Nelson, do you have any examples of how this is, who's been really hurt by this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to your question, Madam Chair, when you say hurt by it, this is a new provision being put in place. I'll have to offer a slight correction to Representative Rukavina. Historically, severance pay was fully deductible from 1936 until 1965. In 1965, there were some modifications made so it was partially deductible to that extent. You correct, there were limitations from 1965 until the mid-90s, and then in the mid-90s we went back to the original provisions, which made it fully deductible. So for about still 30 years, it was partially deductible. Now severance pay is fully, I shouldn't use the word deductible, but it delays the onset of benefits. If you receive severance, you have to, in effect, use up the severance, and after that you can collect unemployment benefits up to your 26 weeks if you still remain unemployed.
What this provision would do is put something new in place, which would say the first $5,000 of severance would not be considered. We know currently 8,000 people a year receive a severance payment from an employer in varying amounts. So this would affect almost all of those people who would receive additional benefits. And we simply, when the cost came up originally, I told Representative Rukavina last year when this bill was introduced, it would cost about $8 million, but that were based on 2005 figures. If you apply it, we took a snapshot the other day of what it would cost had it been in place in 2007, and that would be an additional cost to the unemployment insurance system of about $10 million. It increases out in the future because unemployment benefits have an automatic escalator in them, so the more unemployment benefit costs, our weekly benefit amounts go up automatically. I should say there's an automatic trigger. That's why the cost will increase in the future is projected if the same number of people receive severance. We've also seen that the number of people applying for unemployment benefits are, well, not overall on the rise, have not decreased at all in the last 2 years. So that's why there are increased costs, the same number of people, but those people are receiving more in unemployment benefits, and that's why the cost would go up.
Representative Rukavina, this wasn't really my language, but you take it.
Representative Murphy, you remember quite well because you got to take over the workforce development part of this bill and conference committee. And I initially started at $25,000 because
right. That's
what some of the folks at the Ford Motor Company were getting, that had worked 30 years of their life and had negotiated this in a union contract and probably had given up other things in order to get a severance package. And being a good Democratic farmer laborite, I thought, you know, this is really something that was in place, as Mr. Nelson said, for 30-some years, taken out during the Carlson administration. And I compromised down to 10, and then I don't think I went to 5, and you're right, you told me 7.5 and about 5 after that because of retroactivity. It might be a little higher now, but remember, you know, you say it might cost more in the future, Mr. Nelson, but you know, as the unemployment insurance number goes up, it's not the fault of somebody on severance pay, and the tax, unemployment tax, automatically goes up too, right? It's correct, and it automatically goes up to make up. We collect about $1 billion a year in UI taxes, if you want to call it a tax, and I guess it is $1 billion a year. It's a very insignificant amount, and you know, I think that. For the folks that support us on this, that believe in the collective bargaining process, and even those that aren't, I had a number of constituents at Ainsworth. One close friend of mine worked 25 years of her life at Ainsworth and had to use up her entire 25 years. She got $1,000 a year severance from Ainsworth and had to use all of it up before she could collect unemployment. And I think there's even a hit, but I'm not sure, about as you use your severance package, your ability to qualify, but I'm not sure if I can remember that, and I might be impressed on that right there. But that's the reason why I did it last year. I compromised down to $5,000. I think when somebody puts $25,000 or $30,000 of their life, or 30 years of their life, into a job and gets the severance for it, gets devastated with, you know, a layoff, and then has to spend it all before they can collect a penny of unemployment, whereas the person across the street, you know, that didn't have that, didn't negotiate that, doesn't have to. And that was the reason why. So I hope the committee could support me.
Representative Ruth. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I didn't understand that, and however, I think about the employer who actually gives it. The idea is that we don't want people on unemployment. We want them to be able to have a job, and I'm concerned about the employers. And this would take the dollars and come out of the trust fund, and I just want to clarify with Mr. Nelson, because as I understand, I believe that the trust fund is already underfunded and is a deficit by early 2010, and so how would this affect that then? Mr. Nelson?
Madam Chair, Representative Ruth, Currently, the trust fund is about $1 billion underfunded if you use the state legislative auditor's report a couple of years ago and what they had determined is an adequate level. It is under the latest revenue forecast, the February forecast. The unemployment insurance trust fund is projected to go into deficit status in March of 2010. What this simply means, well, what it means because of its retroactivity, and benefits will be paid out about somewhere around 25 plus million additional benefits this year because of the retroactivity portion. And so taxes will increase on employers to somewhat replenish that, but it will simply deplete the fund a little bit quicker because it gets fairly complicated, but not all benefits paid out are charged back to individual employers. A large portion are, but not all of them are. So the trust fund will go into deficit status a little bit sooner.
That's fair.
Representative Savino.
I just understand. $1 billion a year, and it is projected. It has nothing to do with this amendment. And the cost is fairly insignificant when you look at $1 billion a year by employment tax that you've collected. And the fund is projected. Yes, it is, Mr. Nelson. You're an expert on it, and you work very well with me, and I appreciate it. But what this is you know, what, a tenth of a percent the cost of that fund going into deficit. It has nothing to do with this little severance package. And again, members, I just hope to plead for fairness for some of these people that have given their life and got a little bit and be able to keep just a little bit of what they got. And while I'm on the subject, I should point out to the committee that I hope that the bill stays intact, Representative Ruth, so we don't nick these kids with tuition increases so we can put them to work and they'll pay taxes and they won't be on unemployment.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the introductory remarks, Representative Rude mentioned the issue of the business climate in the state, and I just like to get full information about that. That's a topic that's of great interest to me. I follow it closely. And the statistics that you referenced, the 42nd of the nation, is from one particular study that looks only at taxes and how they affect business climate in states in the United States. By other studies, Minnesota ranks much, much higher. A Forbes ranking of business climate in the United States ranks Minnesota as number 14. And the things that really raise Minnesota up are quality of life and workforce, the quality of our workforce in this state. So I just want to keep the business climate discussion on a broader sectoral basis than one study that's been referenced a couple times this session. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, did I hear you say you're doing this for one of your constituents?
No, I gave one, Madam Chair. It's not for one of my constituents, although I can, you know, certainly not ashamed to do that. No, this is for a lot of people, particularly Ford Motor Company, where a lot of people worked for 30, 35 years of their life, got 25,000 severance, if I'm not mistaken. Some of them got a lot more than that. And then have to spend it all down before they can go file for unemployment insurance.
Madam Chair?
I said one of my constituents worked at Ainsworth for 25 years and they got $1,000 a year and had to spend it all down before they qualified for unemployment.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But didn't Ainsworth reopen?
Is there closed again?
So, this one
they reopened
this one
for about, I don't know, 6-7 months? And shut down again and all.
So did they rehire any of those men, Chair? Did they rehire any of those?
They rehired, yes, quite a few of their folks, but then they're all back on layoff again.
But not the people that had received severance?
No, the people that received severance were let go. That's why they got severance back.
Representative Ruth.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I get to the point, and I'm just going to speak back to and Representative Bunn's comment. The reason I brought it up is that we're very second is because this is a tax increase for employers. Because if the trust fund is depleted, if it's in a deficit, then you know, the federal government, I believe, Mr. Nelson can correct me, but I believe that the federal government
gives us a loan and covers it, but it directly, immediately goes to the employers, and they have to pick up the tab. So it is, I just wanted to clarify that it actually is a tax increase on our employers. So we don't want to go back to 49th.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ruth Cena.
Again, Representative Ruth, whether this is in this bill or not, that we're going to be in deficit in the UI file in 2010. Mr. Nelson, am I right or not?
Mr. Nelson, if I remember correctly, you didn't identify yourself when you came up.
My friend, Representative
Ruth. For the record, Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs for the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
And Madam Chair, I would request a roll call, please.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question before I testify. In terms of the impact on the average employer and the increase, you know, per employee they have of this particular provision, do we have any sense of what that is?
Madam Chair, Representative, as Representative Rukavina correct when he indicated, employers will pay in just short of $1 billion this year on unemployment insurance taxes. What it means is those taxes will go up enough to, they'll go up about another $25 million for the following, for 2009, mm-hmm. and then out into the future. So there will be an increase, and Representative Rukavina is correct. As a percentage, it's a relatively small increase of what the tax will be overall based on $1 billion in total collection.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The issue of if it's a one-to-one deduction of unemployment, I mean, they have to use up their severance before receiving it. Is it on a $1 to $1 basis? Because my question is, I'm not sure we should also be, I'm sensitive to the tax issue on this issue, so I'm not quite sure how I'm voting on this yet, but I'm also concerned that we're discouraging people from offering severance to employees. You know, that I would think we would want firms to offer, we wouldn't want to discourage it necessarily. And yet if we don't have any provisions at least allow them to keep a portion of it, we're essentially telling firms and employees there's no advantage to, offering severance to employees.
Mr. Nelson.
And Chair, Representative, what happens on severance? And severance is paid out by the employers in different manners. Sometimes it's paid in a lump sum. Sometimes it's paid weekly. It's paid in all different manners. I've seen it in all different manners. But what we do is we take the total an individual will receive, and we divide it by their last level of weekly pay to determine the number of weeks of severance at their last pay level they will receive. And then we take that out and say, okay, now you're ineligible for unemployment benefits for that number of weeks. So you're receiving, in effect, full pay. Unemployment benefits are half pay. And your full unemployment benefit entitlement is available to you after that severance is applied. Since most people do not exhaust their full entitlement to benefits, unemployment benefits, which is normally about 26 weeks, it's a little less than that. But most people don't collect that amount. Right now it's about 16 weeks in Minnesota. So that's why if you say the first $5,000 isn't deductible, they start collecting a little bit sooner, and that's why they'll collect a little more on unemployment benefits, those 8,000 people. And that's where this cost incurs. Some of the argument by Representative Gunther last night was this would provide a disincentive, and it's one of the administration's positions, this would provide a disincentive for employers to provide severance because it simply means their cost is going to go up. If you don't deduct it, their costs, so they're less likely to provide a severance package if this bill were in place. And some of it might be take issue with Representative Rukavina. When people now negotiate their contracts, they're well aware of the existing law. It's been in place for well over 10 or 15, about 10 or 12 years, 15 years. So they're well aware of it. They're well aware of the impact of this. And when unions negotiate it, they do that in relation to the current law.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nelson, is severance taxed? Is that taxable income?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, severance pay is considered wages, so it's not only taxed for income tax purposes, it's taxed for Social Security purposes. All taxes are paid. It is also taxed for unemployment insurance purposes as wages. And this is where, but it gets extremely complex. An employer has to report that as wages to the worker. A worker can actually collect unemployment benefits based on a severance package. I could explain where that works, especially if the employer pays it and spread out. A worker could, in effect, collect benefits based on severance, never having actually formed services to collect benefits based on the severance package. It is considered wages for all purposes.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Again, for Representative Klein, I mean, for my employer, for my constituent that I represent, under the way I have it structured, he would have gotten her average, half of her average wage, the unemployment, for until she exhausted the $20,000 or the $25,000. And then she would have gotten to keep that and gone on unemployment. The whole time she was doing that, she would have been taxed on unemployment insurance and other things on the severance, even though she couldn't collect unemployment insurance to fix that. So it seems rather unfair, and it's just a minuscule amount as far as when you look at it in relation to the whole UI fund. It's $1 billion a year is going to go on the deficit in 2010, not because of the severance. I'm more than willing to work with Mr. Nelson. I think his concerns are more about the retroactivity, but, you know, to me it's a philosophical thing, and I'm willing to work with him. As you were, Madam Chair, last
time. That's correct. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, is severance going to continue to be something that is paid in the business world? It seems to me it's an archaic method of rewarding your employees because it is taxed. And why wouldn't an employer instead put it into like a health benefit package, which I think many school districts are doing today? So is severance actually going to stay around?
Representative Rukavina.
I think they call them golden parachutes when they go to the CEOs, and they're a lot more than $25,000 in that. And they seem to be going up and not going down or disappearing. So.
A26. Clerk will take the roll.
Rukavina?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Greiling? Mariani?
No.
Wallach?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Demmer?
Yes.
Abler? Brown?
No.
Bunn?
Yes.
Eastland? Erickson?
Yes.
Garofalo? Hamilton?
Yes.
Ed Gerken? Ornstein? Kranz? Mason?
No.
Kowalski?
No.
Ruth?
Yes.
Rude? Tilbury?
No.
Ward?
No.
Wardlow?
Yes.
Greiling?
No.
Abler? Eastland? Garofalo? Hyde Gerken? Hornstein? Kranz? Rude?
Thank you.
6-11, the motion is not adopted. Representative Ward, 828.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was told that Representative Rucavina is in favor of this amendment and has worked out an agreement with another representative. So, Representative Rucavina, I'm going to call on you to speak to this amendment.
It's
828. Lifetrack Resources.
Oh, yes. Representative Norton and Representative Hortman have agreed to it doesn't change any of the shifts of money that was in the program for Representative Hortman. $200,000 program, it takes $75,000 and that's what they two worked out that financing.
Any discussion, Representative Erickson?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ward, what's the need for this?
Representative Erickson, as I came in today, I think the need is in front of us here, but as I came in today, I was asked to support and offer this amendment for, as Representative Rucavina said, as an agreement between Representative Hortman and Representative Norton for a one-time pilot project in Rochester.
Representative Flawless.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, this is an organization I worked with in the past, Lifetrack Resources. They're down on University, not far from here. They also work with immigrant communities. And I know when I was in Representative Gunther's committee, which handled workforce development issues, we also had a grant back then for this. And what it helped was it's an immigrant and refugee collaborative program. So I know we had people come and testify about working in hospitals, just starting out those jobs we think about that probably a lot of people wouldn't want to take, helping immigrant folks learn how to have their first job and work and do all those types of things. So I know the program that we did was really, really successful here in the Twin Cities, and I had talked with Trixie Goldberg, the executive director of Lifetrack, and I know she wanted to expand down in Rochester because there's a need for that down there. I think when we talk about different populations and training folks for jobs, it's important that we provide some support for that. So I think that's what this does. And I think our program was, I don't know, Gunther was, what was that, about 4 years ago that he was chair? We were on that committee together. So we did a similar program up here then.
Yeah. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rucavina, whenever we have these grants, they seem to turn into funding now on the base. So do you know how many grants have turned into funding for the base of each budget that we appropriate dollars for in this legislature?
I suppose, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I could have Mr. Berg help me on that. A lot of our programs last year in the bill were one-time programs, but I couldn't really tell you offhand. I mean, there were ongoing base programs. A lot of the bill got vetoed, so I can't remember what got vetoed and what didn't, but a number of our appropriations last year, let's say for the, actually, where I think the money is coming from the reduction in the $200,000 program for Representative Hortman, I think it's a one-time appropriation, if I'm not mistaken, but Mr. Berg's nodding his head yes, so these were one-time appropriations. I think that language for Representative another program in here, the language for it, or that amendment that Representative Garofalo added was a program until the money was gone. Slocum bill in here is, I think, a one-time program, and the only actual ongoing base programs in here are the ones requested by the governor, which I mentioned in my initial opening remarks, like on the veterans program for displaced workers as a business loan program that's ongoing. His initiative science and technology grant, I think, is ongoing. Oh, okay, I'm corrected. That's one time. So yeah, and then the new martial arts court or whatever it's called is not going in here for $80,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Rucavina, couldn't the private sector start up a business like this and provide the same kind of services instead of
the legislature doing these one-time grants all the time. I mean, something must happen to these organizations after we stop funding them. So wouldn't this be a great incentive for someone in the private sector?
Well, Madam Chairman, that's a good point. And in the Fall Review, you know, there was matching state and business community money. In fact, some of the bigger employees in the state located here in the metro area came forward to support it a couple of weeks ago in committee. But when the state money runs out, it seems that the business community then loses their interest. So I don't know if we could get some matching money. It would be nice, and perhaps we could, you know, get Representative Norton to promise to go to the Mayo and have them. They got a little bit of money down there. Maybe they could match this $75,000. But right now, there is a need, as Representative Slawick said, because of the large, both me and, you know, my Croat and countrymen and Somalis down in that community that, to use the same program that Representative Mariani has in St. Paul, it's been extremely successful, and those students came and testified last year, and it's a very successful program. So,
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They say in the bill that it's a collaborative effort. Do they work with business and other groups as well to make this program work?
This is just an amendment being offered by Representative Ward. It wasn't in the bill, and what you see, Representative Peterson, is what's there is that $75,000 for LifeTrack, which is a business or a community action program here, a non-profit, I believe, here in St. Paul to extend this to Rochester. So once the money runs out, I think it runs out, Representative.
On favor of the Ward Amendment, A28, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion is adopted. Representative Bruce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an amendment that Susan Hegard and
has no number.
It has no number. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Did I have no?
Oh, we don't have it.
Oh, it's being handed out, I guess. Well, it's being handed.
It's the amendment that Susan Hegard, Director of Higher Ed, Office of Higher Ed, told us about when she made her presentation on what the P16 was doing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And currently, this language, you all have another language, is in the K-12 policy bill, I believe, in the House. And so just an ask if we can put this into the higher ed bill as well, because in the Senate, it is in the higher education bill, so we can match the Senate. And as you can see, it's so that the two offices can work together, the Department of Education and the Office of Higher Education.
Representative Frucadina.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Mariani has this in his policy bill, or maybe Representative Filing, but I don't care. I think it's fine. I'm sure Representative Mariani is going to get it passed anyway. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair. I believe it is in both in the data bill and the K-12 and higher ed bill in the Senate. And Ms. Hegard and Commissioner Seagren just wanted to make sure it was in all the bills to make sure that we would get it through so that they would have that. That's okay. Thank you, Representative
Bruce. It's been so nice to me on the committee, and I know if I accept this, you'll be even nicer on the floor. So.
Thank you, Representative Chair.
Representative Bruce Vina, do you have any other amendments?
I don't, Senator.
Do you have one?
No.
All right. He accepted this as a friendly amendment, so it's incorporated.
Aye.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. I was just trying to hurry. I see no other amendments. Representative Rucavina?
Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that the committee report 3722 be recommended passed and referred to the full finance.
Any further discussion? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, in your committee, and I wish I did serve on it, maybe some day I may, but have you ever compiled a list of the salaries earned by the presidents or the chancellor of the institutions, or your chancellor, the presidents of the institutions, the president of the University of Minnesota, as well as the top paid professors? I think we should collect that data, because every time we talk about tuition having to increase, the question that arises in my mind is this. Is a professor who is making $700,000, and I don't deny that professor that, is he teaching our students in the classroom, or is he doing something else, or it could be a she? Because we need to look at the value that our students are getting by paying these kinds of tuition rates at either MINSU or the University of Minnesota. And I feel very strongly that if a professor gets paid a six-figure income, well-deserved, but then I expect him to be in the classroom teaching my children, and I would think other parents do as well. So I hope we collect that data and we have that debate about not interfering, but what, how do we define value when it comes to our institutions setting tuition versus what our students get out of the teaching staff of those institutions? I think we really have to take a look at that, because the tuition in Minnesota is rising, and I don't think it has that much to do with what we're doing. I think it has to do with the fact that there's an easy come, easy sell to go to our post-secondary institutions, and so the salaries of our professors and our other staff can increase because there's a ready and willing audience. But I think parents need to be aware that not always do their children receive the kind of education they should, because these highly paid and highly qualified staff are not really their teachers.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
A lot of the information regarding the MINSU system, of course, is public, and it is public. We had that discussion on the House floor last week about the administration at MINSU, I believe.
Yes.
And the and the IFO, if I'm not the IFO contract, which is ratified. I don't think our either our 4-year professors or 2-year professors' salaries in Minnesota are out of line. In fact, I think one of them is much lower than, is it the 4-year institution? Yeah. The 4-year institutions are much lower than surrounding states. The 2-year is a little better. At the university, you know, they have their autonomy, they claim, and I think the highest paid professor is maybe in the $400,000 range. I know the basketball coach gets a lot more, but you know, I think the classroom contact is, you know, something that is negotiated. And a lot of those researchers, and in fact, in the bonding bill this year of the American is $250 million that's going to have to be carried eventually in this bill. A few years old, I got it down to about, I think, 14 or so million. It is 16, but I got it down to a little bit, Mr. Berg, by going to 66-33 instead of 80-20, which it was in the bonding bill. And, you know, those researchers come to the university to bring in research dollars. And, you know, I mean, there's one researcher just recently that you saw that, I think, a brilliant woman that was pulled away from somewhere that structured hearts. Now, some of us could probably use her help, but, you know, to build a heart from scratch, is a pretty phenomenal thing, and so that's the type of things going on at the University of Minnesota. But the information is pretty much there for us to look over right now. And I don't have, you know, as you go up from the 2-year system where the contact with the students is, I think, about 16 or 12 hours of, to 16 hours a week, I'm not sure, to the 4 years where it's a little less, to the university where it's less than that. Yeah, but they're doing other things, and they've got to have the preparation time, and it's not the same as your contact, which was probably, depending, you know, whether you were elementary or high school, 5 to 6 hours of contact a day. Seven. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's something we have to talk about. But, you know, Representative Pawlowski has been very adamant in holding the central office to speak to the fire, and in this bill we basically take all the money from the, we do take all the money from the central office, from the technology money that they went a little overboard with last year, and from the chancellor's office, and you know, those types of things I think have to continue to be looked at. But for some of the smaller colleges in the state that can't afford human resource people and take, you know, other folks like that, that works done out of the central office. So, in this bill, there's one other thing I should mention, and it's a reduction in student share because of the anticipated federal $15 million, which, you know, for the poorest of our students means another 300 and Doug, is it, what, 18 bucks a year, so.
Thank you. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Rukavina, that's the second time now we've got a chance to go through one of your bills, and I appreciate the work that you do, and I understand your advocacy and where you feel strong about it. I'm not going to be able to support your bill today. It comes as a great surprise, I'm sure. Just a couple of things I'm going to point out, and these are just examples. I am disappointed, for example, that we would dictate to and put in statute that we'd have to have 4 members of the union. Would they have to be put in statute in order for them to get on the Minsky board? It's over 25% of the Minsky board, Representative Rukavina, and I just don't agree with that sort of you know, carving out that sector for certain types of membership. We haven't done that in Minsky and the board, and I'm disappointed we're doing that here. Another thing that kind of concerns me, the power of you. I think it sounds like an interesting program, but to use state taxpayer dollars from my area to do scholarships for Minneapolis and St. Paul students, I don't understand why we're going there. I don't see why we're taking state tax dollars and funding scholarships for just 2 schools. I don't agree with that. And quite frankly, the teachers of color scholarships are a good thing, usually based on merit, usually based on need, that sort of thing. But based on the color of their skin, Representative Rukavina, I question that. And the last comments I would make are regarding, and Representative Ruth did a good job of pointing out the severance issues with the unemployment. You know, this is an additional tax on employers, there's no question, by saying that they are not, and also to other employees, and there's another place in the bill too where you for the lumber yard, they say they get increased benefits, but it's not attributable, the cost is not attributable to that employer. That just means the rest of the state employers have to pay that, and again, it's just going after employers again. And the last comment that I would make, this is a thing that I picked up quickly that concerned me in the bill, is actively seeking work when you're unemployed. To say that that employees only have to go to certain places to seek work, as opposed to just taking work that's available any place. Again, it's I don't think it's good public policy to say, well, you only have to go to certain places to seek work. If there's work someplace else, you don't have to ask them because that's not good enough to work for. I just don't think it's good public policy, Representative Rukavina, so I can't support your bill for that. But other than that, thanks for your work, and it's been good working on this, and we'll look forward to talking about it on the House floor.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
I want to reiterate that the Power of You program in this bill opens it up not just to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but to 2 new suburban sites and 2 new rural sites. Number one. Number two, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but Mr. Nelson, I don't know if Mr. Nelson is still here, but that, I don't think that request by ASL-CIO for their members on the bench, and that was an issue, if I'm mistaken. It wasn't an issue at all with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which you referred to there. And then, as far as the makeup of the Minsky Board, again, I think people, you know, we dictate that there's 3 students from each one of the, or is it 2 or 3, I think, 3, from each one of the systems, 3 on the board. And so to have someone from the IFO and NAEP and AFSCME and the 2-year teaching institutions, I think, is a good. A lot of our school districts across the state have elected members that sit on their school boards, and I think they bring a good perspective to those boards, not anything to be worried about. So that was my only concern there. So, you know, they university has always had a labor spot on the Board of Regents, and I just thought it was something that would be good for Mintfield. But Representative Demmer, I know you can't support everything, but I think deep down you appreciate the fact that I didn't stick the students with another tuition. I can see it smiling. I think.
Representative Rukavina renews this motion. House File 3722 be recommended to pass on to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted.
Thank
Good
you,
job, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you,
The Thank committee you. Has not is not over. Representative Slawick has to be heard from because one of our tasks is the early childhood division, and we oversight that, and we need a short report. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You say the best for last, right?
That's right.
I appreciate it. I have a very brief report, members. As the Early Childhood Committee, the good news is we had a zero target. So with a zero target, of course, we had no bill going forward today. In some ways, that was sort of shocking for our committee. We are meeting no more and doing no more work. So one thing I want to do briefly is thank the members of the committee who are on this committee, Representative Ward, Representative Kranz, Representative Peterson, Representative Wardlow, Representative Garofalo, Representative Eastland, who is the Republican lead. I also want to thank the staff, Sarah Benz-Kofer and Matthew Cawley. We did a lot of committee work, Madam Chair. We heard how we did on our bills from last year on things like allowances, what's happening with child care. We did an ECFE licensure bill. We worked on some SIDS language about how an infant should sleep on their back, and heard a number of interesting bills. But when we didn't have a fiscal target, that was kind of the end of our committee meeting. So with that, Madam Chair and members, we are looking at setting 75% of kids being ready by 2016 as our goal, and we want to work with Representative Breitling and her committee on major reforms and trying to see if we can get a major push for early childhood funding next year. We are grateful, Madam Chair, for your work, and that a zero target is a good target. We are the only ones that had no cuts, no increase, but no cuts. And so I think that's a signal to the state that we want to preserve the investments in early childhood that we made in Head Start, in school readiness, and in ECFE, and continue to let the little kids of the state continue to flourish. So thank you.
Very good.
Okay.
There is no other business to come before this committee. I thank you for your participation and your endurance today. This is the longest committee we have ever had. And the chair said that they would need 10 minutes for their bills to be heard. And so I knew better. But this is good. And it's good that we're done at 3:15. So they did not anticipate all the bumps in the road, so to speak. But I think the product that we heard today can go forth with not our good wishes, but indeed they are with our good wishes, but it's not something that we like. Last year's bills coming through this committee were a lot more fun, as has been expressed already. It's much better to be able to go forth without cutting. But it's never bad to review what we have done. And so we will be, your bills will be heard tomorrow and Thursday in Finance Committee, so it's going to be another long afternoon, I bet, right?
All day tomorrow, man.
So this meeting is adjourned.
Indeed.